Zane Lowe, Apple Music.
In the lexicon of rock and roll, I mean, it's hard to get past a band like The Who. Some would argue, and they wouldn't be wrong, that they're probably, if not the biggest, definitely one of the most influential rock groups in modern history. And just look at the firsts or near firsts that Pete Townshend, Roger Daltrey, John Entwistle, and Keith Moon were right there for. That original chaos from the mod scene right into mainstream success and all of the craziness that followed, but also real legitimate groundbreaking moves like taking that mainstream success, turning it on its head and opposing the system. They are a revolutionary rock and roll group through and through, always searching to give those that feel a little bit downtrodden in society a stronger voice to fight back. Taking it as far as destruction across their instruments on stage, which is divisive and some people find really gross because there are a lot of people out there who wish they had instruments to learn how to play, but as an expression, well, Pete Townshend will explain it better than I ever could. And I had no idea about this, but Pete also told me in this conversation you're about to hear that he was the first person to ever invest in a home recording studio, inspiring people like Paul McCartney to go and do the same. And now, look up and down your street where you live. I guarantee you that they are dotted in every single apartment, flat, and home as far as you can see. Home recording is everywhere. The relationship between Pete Townshend and Roger Daltrey is famously prickly. And yet both of them had wonderful things to say about each other in these conversations. And I guess have reached a point in their lives where they don't have to answer that question to anyone anymore because the proof is in the music and the work. But what they did have to answer is, why are you going back and revisiting over 100 outtakes and releasing a super deluxe version of their seminal album and also another first rock and roll record really to ever be considered a concept album, right? Why redo it? Pete Townshend will give you one answer. Roger Daltrey will give you another one. And that's the beauty of this episode right here in the interview series. You're about to hear from both of them. So take notes. Pete Townshend and Roger Daltrey from The Who in conversation right now. Enjoy it. So how was it, Pete? How was it going through and just kind of, I don't know, reminiscing and reflecting through your own work, you know, which is not something you often do.
You know, I do it quite a lot. I've got demos of everything that The Who have ever done since the very first recordings. And for this, I did the work on the demos for this back in 2017. So I finished in April because that was the 50th anniversary year and I thought it was going to be an anniversary package. I love it. I love it today because I was working on old tape machines back then. The tapes have lasted pretty well, but some of them are stretched. Some of them, you know, were recorded very cheaply. And with modern computers, I can fix a lot of the problems.
But it's also a lot of those problems are what's so awesome about them. And I think if you're an audiophile, if you love sound, beyond just melody and music and racket and rock and all the things that come from being a musician, if you love diving into the sound of things, there's something so magic about the fact that age actually plays a part in the way things end up back then. Now, age is not going to make any difference. Those digital files will remain the same. But you go back to those tapes and you haven't touched them and things have changed, right?
That's exactly right, Zane. You know, I think music has changed a lot even since the birth of digital sound. I was the first musician that I knew in pop that had my home studio. I had my first studio in like 1963, something like that. And I persuaded people like Paul McCartney and a few DJs like Kenny Everett in the UK to build their own studios to work at home. And now, of course, we have laptops. That's what I dreamed of, was having a small box that I could take on the road, plug a mic into and make a record. And now you can do that. But what's actually happened is the quality of the music hasn't really changed that much. In fact, a lot of people that use laptops want plugins, they want devices built into their laptops that make it sound like it did in the 60s, you know. So
you've been making music through all of this and you are a futurist. You're not afraid of progress. You never have been. I say that as an observer, but a fan, so I feel confident making that statement. So in a weird way, I'm sure people like me assume that you are in love with these old demos and the way they sound, but you do love the way technology pushes things forward, don't you? You always were pushing things forward.
Yeah, I do. I really love it. I'm lucky because I can use both. You know, I still have all that old stuff. So I can mix and match. And I do really like soft synths. I do, because I think one of the things about them is that you can open a laptop, play something with a little mini keyboard, and be inspired. And I think when I go back to the old analog synths, what I'm looking for is not a particular sound or a particular grunge or anything. I'm looking always for inspiration. I'm always looking for a song. You know, I feel if I went out tomorrow and bought a soft synth that cost, you know, $100, it would be $100 well spent if I got a song out of it. Equally, if I went out and bought, you know, spent $100,000 on an old Moog and I got a song out of it, it would be worth it. That's all I care about.
Do you ever become a fan in order to be inspired? Rather than just go to the instrument and go to the source, do you ever go to the records that inspired you as a kid or things that you love in the hope that it's going to spark? Or is that kind of almost sacrilegious? Does it feel almost plagiaristic?
No, I do it. And I've done it a lot recently because I set this room up as a listening room. I used to have a cinema, which was all surround sound. And I thought, I'm going to get Dolby Atmos. And then I thought, no, screw it. What I really want is a room with two speakers, a deck, and access to my vinyl, and a little box which will feed from my laptop or my iPhone. You know, so I listen to new music and old music. I'm not quite so adept at listening to new music as Elton John, but I do listen to a lot of new music. And I listen to anything that he recommends, for example. Because he's so on the ball. He listens to everything.
There's more people who love music and want to be invested in music than I feel than ever before. There's more music being made and being released. This was not the case, obviously, back in, you know, the mid-60s when you formed The Who and you came out. You released two albums and immediately you were faced with a fair amount of attention. In fact, you were the first in so many ways, in so many areas. Rock and roll, the idea of rock and roll actually breaking through. Pretty unheard of. You were on the sweep of a change within culture, mod culture, bringing in a new rebellious, but also kind of responsible young approach to living life. There was a certain, in a weird way, there was
There was a
credo to which the kind of mods tried to live their life to some degree, right? There was some kind of righteousness invested in that space.
There was definitely, but thinking back about those days, the 60s, I think it was in the 70s that I started to feel really honestly that rock music, the function of rock music and of pop music too. Remember, I was the child of a guy who played saxophone in a post-war dance band. He knew what his music was for. It was for post-war. It was for dancing with a woman that you might end up marrying. It was about romance, dreams, fantasy. Music, even today, is about much more than that. It has a function, which is to help us understand what's going on in the world, to understand us what's going on inside us. So the purpose and the duty of somebody that makes music is very different than the way it used to be. And I think I may have been the first not to know about that. I think everybody that made music in rock and pop knew that, but I was the first to articulate it and try to explain it. And I think I still feel that really, really strongly. I won't sit down and just write a song. Well, I will just sit down and write a song for fun, but you'll probably never hear it.
How do you know when it gets into that magic space and it's something that resonates deeper than just, like you say, fun, the frivolity, and it gets to a place where there's depth to its value? How do you know? What's the feeling you get? Can you articulate it after all these years? Are you better at articulating it?
You know, when if we go back to the Who Sell Out, there's a lot of stuff on that album. And the whole story of the album was that we were on the road a lot in 67. We did Monterey Pop Festival. We did a first series of shows in New York. We went to the Fillmore, in a legendary Fillmore in San Francisco, and did a bunch of shows. We actually were supported by the great jazz sax player Cannonball Adderley. It was just blew my mind that we would be on a show with somebody like that.
I mean, that is crossing mad genres back then. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. You see that at a festival now, but back then that must have seemed so strange. But the energy is the same.
Yeah, he was such a cool guy as well. But I think it was busy and I was writing all the time. And when we came to consider putting an album out around Christmas 67, It was a real rag bag of stuff, but quite a few of the songs were my first attempts to deal with the metaphysics, to deal with the abstract nature of music, to deal with manic depression. You know, the song Melancholia, was the working title was originally The Virus. You know, it was about mental illness as a virus. Now we have a virus which is leading to mental illness. You know, it's the other way around. So some of the songs were very serious, but most of them were really flippant, you know, lighthearted. Some of them were funny. Some of them were meant to be amusing, meant to be distracting, meant to be, you know, about advertising and about the commercial world of advertising.
But you're right. There was a Trojan horse to that album. There's a sense of being brought in and you're immediately drawn to the eccentricities of it. But actually, a song like Tattoo, which really is, to me, a way in many respects of making a strong statement about independence, rebellion, what it's like to be on the front line of, and I'm going to make this term up, so God knows if it makes sense, but it almost felt like, it almost feels like you were on the verge of a meta-masculine revolution of like, I'm not going to be the masculine you think I need to be. That's a serious concept at that time.
I think that's right. I think the song was meant to challenge that. It wasn't meant to make, because now we have tattoos and men that wear tattoos are actually using tattoos to defy masculine stereotypes.
Right. That's right.
So it's turned it on its head.
That's right. The idea of me going and getting a tattoo back then was just like, I'm not going to be a builder, Dad. Now it's like, it's the complete opposite. I got to get into what weaves through the Who sell out. The idea of radio, the idea of jingles, the concept, again, very well traveled now. So many people have used radio to weave through their music. Dr. Dre, you know, incredible artists have chosen that idea of radio being the voice behind the voice. When you were doing it, you really came from that place of pirate radio. Why? What was it about that particular aesthetic that you really wanted to lean into to help tell the story of the Who Sell Out?
I think it was a celebration. 1967 was when pirate radio was banned in the UK by the government. They were always annoyed by it because the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, was deepened its grip on broadcasting in the UK during the war. It became the voice of the nation. There's a thing called the BBC World Service, which is listened to all around the world in I think it's 50 different languages. So the idea that these guys could go out on a ship in the North Sea or off the coast of Ireland and broadcast to teenagers in the UK unlicensed was an anathema to the government at the time. Whether it was a left-wing or a right-wing government, I can't remember. But I do remember that without them, I feel that without them, you wouldn't have had the Stones, you wouldn't have had the Beatles, you wouldn't have had the Kinks, you wouldn't have had any of the really creative artists of that time.
You wouldn't have had me. My father was one of four pirates who launched a pirate radio station in New Zealand in 1966, inspired by Caroline.
Oh, wow.
And went out into international waters and did everything step by step that Caroline did, except for one really important thing. They actually won. And they actually won a license from the New Zealand government and launched the first ever New Zealand rock and roll radio station. And they spent two or three years in international waters. So the whole idea of pirate radio is so ingrained in my life, the story of what it is to rebel against the controlling mechanism of media, which is like more prevalent than ever before today, right? The idea of how do you control the media? Yeah. It's crazy.
It's so interesting. I remember now that there was a pirate radio station in New Zealand. I remember.
That's my dad.
We were in New Zealand in 67. We did a tour there with the Small Faces.
Wow.
When we gathered all this stuff together, I said to our managers and our record producer, I said, let's sell commercials between the tracks. Let's make commercial songs. Let's make songs about products. I'd done two songs for the American Cancer Society to discourage people from smoking, which was a bit hypocritical because I smoked. But they were good songs.
Hang on, hold that thought. How does that work? Listen,
I didn't get paid for it, so I didn't.
That's not an excuse. All right, check this out. I do love it though. Like for anyone who knows your history, your dedication to philanthropy and to trying to kind of raise money and awareness for, you know, for disease prevention, right through to common sense. I would call that a bit of both. But how do you sort of factor in? Is it just young man contradiction that you're able to sort of wake up that morning and know that you've just done something that's sort of against the idea of smoking and then you light one up and puff one? I mean, how does that work?
It just wouldn't have even come into my mind. you know, I was 22. Just wouldn't have come into my mind. I remember telling my manager off, because Kit Lambert used to smoke. He's our manager and producer. Used to smoke Senior Service cigarettes, no tips, filter tips, you know, and he smoked 3 packs of these a day, so 60 a day, and chain smoked them. And he said, "Pete, the thing is about the way I smoke cigarettes is that I only smoke the first inch. So it's much healthier." But I said to him, you know, we can't do an anti-smoking campaign when all of us smoke. I knew the level of hypocrisy I was working in. The weird thing about the song Little Billy is that I made an even bigger gaffe when seen from, you know, 2021, which was that the song is about this kid called Little Billy. And the reason that he lives longer than all of the kids who smoke is, hey, he's fat. But he doesn't smoke. So although he's fat, he lives longer than all of the kids who are not fat because he doesn't smoke, folks.
One of the most important things about this album isn't just the quality of songwriting, and we're on a fast track to talk about that. It's also the fact that, you know, it started you on this journey of leaning into the idea of, and this is another well-trodden topic or term, but concept albums, whatever that is, the idea of it being more than just 12 songs in a row. It's like, it can have a theme, it can have an intro, it can have an outro, it can have narrative, characters, protagonists. It can be all of these things. But this was the first of that kind for you, wasn't it? This was when you were like, what's behind the curtain?
You know, it wasn't quite the first. On the second album we did, which was called A Quick One, there was a track called A Quick One While He's Away, which was a mini opera.
Oh, yes.
It was 6 short songs linked together. After that album came out, I met Paul McCartney in a nightclub, and he took me aside and he said, "Pete, that mini opera thing is so cool." He didn't actually say, "Would you mind if we did something like it?" But the inference was that they were already considering doing something long form. And very, very soon after, early in, I think it was in May of 67, we were on the road, Sgt. Pepper came out. Before that, at the end of 66 in America, Pet Sounds came out by the Beach Boys. And although neither of them were narrative concepts, they were definitely poetic stories. They were gatherings of images and ideas that added up to a new way of putting songs together. And from that moment on, I think the message was out there, if that's what you want to do, do it. You know, and other people did it in strange ways. If you look at a band like AC/DC, every album was a concept album. And guess what the concept was? It was AC fucking DC.
Exactly.
That was the concept.
Exactly.
You know? But they stuck to it. They religiously stuck to it. So everybody knew where they were and who they were and what they were doing. And it was a faithful, almost religious program of dedication to a story. And the story was slight changes. Many, many of the big heavy metal bands did the same thing. And in fact, in heavy metal, there was a huge number of concept albums, you know, which most of us would probably not know about.
In the title itself, let alone in the artwork and then the jingles and everything that rolls into it. And to your point, you were genuine about trying to sell out. You were trying to sell space on this record. This isn't an irony thing. You weren't being ironic. And yet everyone's probably sort of figured that over time that, you know, oh, it's like, oh yeah, well, we'll just call ourselves sellout before anyone else could call us a sellout. And you're like, no. I'm all about this. Do you know what I mean? And it's, in a way, this album kind of started this whole strange relationship between the idea of credibility, independent thought, and how far you can go as an artist in order to make a living or in order to collaborate or try new things. And I can only imagine the amount of artists that didn't take the opportunity because of fear for being judged for that term selling out, which you coined. And so it must have been very interesting, the idea of seeing this concept album become part of culture and ultimately influence decision-making over the years.
I think that's true. I went to art college and studied graphic design and advertising. So it was in my head. And one of the things that's so interesting about advertising is that a company that does ads for TV or for magazines or whatever, they can sometimes have, you know, $100 million in their bank account. because they are the ones who buy the advertising for their client. So they've got all these huge amounts of money. They get very, very heady. Somewhere in all this, I thought quite seriously that we would make quite a lot of money. So I got Chris Stamp, our manager, to call up Coca-Cola. We had done a commercial for Coca-Cola, which was in the cinemas. Ray Charles did one, Diana Ross did one, and the only other person in the 60s to do one was The Who. And I thought, you know, they'll buy time. So I was trying to sell, you know, the gaps in between the vinyl. I thought, well, instead of those gaps, if we widen them a little bit, we can sell commercials. Anyway, I said to Chris, so what happened when you spoke to the guys at Coke? He said, oh, you know, they were sort of interested, but they asked me how many albums we're likely to sell. So I exaggerated and I said, well, maybe 100,000. And he said, the guy put the phone down. Just put the phone down.
You're playing with Madison Avenue right now. 100,000, yeah. What is that? You know, I'm fired.
The only company that responded even slightly positively was a company called Rotosound Strings, who gave John Entwistle free strings for the rest of his life. Oh, and Premier Drums were already giving Keith Moon free drums to smash up. Nobody ever gave me free guitars. I don't know why, but they didn't.
No one ever gave you free guitars? That's crazy.
Not once.
You kidding? No one ever came to you and said, hey, alongside, I should say, Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page, you're the single most influential guitar player in the history of modern music. Here's a guitar. No one ever did that.
You know, a few people gave me guitars as presents and, you know, I still got them. I wouldn't smash them. But no, I don't think anybody wanted to trust me. In case I decided I needed an artistic moment, you know.
Can you talk us through a couple of the guitars that have been gifted to you? Because I'm always fascinated by that, the idea of actually sharing an instrument with somebody that you care about, because holding on to an instrument is a precious experience. So you really got to care about somebody when you want to pass it on. Can you talk about a couple of the gifts that you've been given over the years and what they mean to you?
You know, I was given a Levin guitar, acoustic guitar, by the very, very brilliant acoustic guitar player, Gordon Giltrap. He saw me in a photo in 1962. Roger was the lead guitar player. And he later got me to play lead guitar, but I was rhythm player at the time. And I had a Levin guitar, and Gordon tracked down a really beautiful one for me and gave it to me recently, and it's really amazing, because what's interesting about it is if I'd have had that guitar, I probably would have given it away to charity. I probably would have done, you know, when somebody said, have you got anything for this charity, I would have said, well, I've got the guitar that I used to use in 1962, and it probably would have sold for $1,000. And then I would have thought, I would have paid $5,000 to keep it, you know. So, and then the other one, which was really important, was the guitar that Roger happened to be playing at that time, which was an Epiphone, solid body Epiphone, called a Coronet, Epiphone Coronet, a single. The pickup is called a P90, little black pickup. And I used that guitar for a long time. I was even still using it. He decided he was going to be the singer one day. He sacked the singer, put the guitar down, gave it to me. It's yours. I don't think I ever gave him any money for it. And I've still got that one too. That's a really good one. I've also given guitars away. You know, I've given a 12-string guitar to an up-and-coming girl guitar player called Ariel. And she's making her own guitar with Brian May at the moment, which comes out soon. And she's promised to let me have one of those. You know, I will cherish it.
You're right. They are things to cherish. And yet you found yourself more often than not in the middle of an artistic, I think you called it an artistic moment. Something impulsive that occurs on stage that at the time seems so out of character for the normally kind of studious musician who focuses on their craft doesn't smash the shit out of it.
Yeah, I don't know who that guy is on stage, but that's, you know, he's a different part of my character.
That's where I was going to go with it. I wanted to know what happens.
Yeah, I don't like performing. I don't have any connection, but that's not what the guitar smashing thing was about, you know. And if I make too much of this, I remember telling this story to an English comedian, a woman, and she said, so why did you smash your guitars? And I told the story. I said, you know, well, it's because at college, there was this guy called Gustav Metzger who could see the, you know, the CO2 Holocaust coming. He said that, you know, the art has to be more responsible. We have to be very, very careful about not falling into a bourgeois place about the tools that we use, either in music or in art. We shouldn't travel to the Venice Biennale. We should, you know, wait to see it in magazines. You know, every time you take a flight, you all of this stuff. And he showed some films. And one of the films was of a guy smashing up a piano. And I completely misunderstood his thesis. I just thought that it was something to do with, you know, my Rickenbacker guitar, the 12 string that I smashed first, partly by accident, but I finished it off in a gig in 63. It cost £350, I think. If you apply inflation to that, I think it's about something like £4,000 or £5,000 or £6,000. You know, I was an art student. I had no money. I was absolutely committed to the artistic act of destroying the tools that I had in my hand. Now, a lot of people would say, yeah, but you were in a band and surely you realize that if you smash your guitar, you weren't going to have a job the following week. I didn't think I'd have a job the following week anyway, because my manifesto for The Who was very punk. It was, this band is terrible. You know, this band is full of idiots. This band is only going to last 6 months at the most.
And that, in essence, is what I think, because it is a divisive statement, and it's crazy to me it still remains a divisive statement. You've seen what happened to Phoebe Bridgers recently on Saturday Night Live when she took her acoustic guitar to task, and my gosh, everyone is still up in arms about this, right? And it splits and it divides. And I think there is a part of it on the side of those that get caught up in the moment with the artist. I've seen great artists do it, where it feels definitive. That is part of what makes it so artistically special, is we know you're going to get up tomorrow and play on that guitar. It'll get put back together or something of its nature. And then the show will go on. But tonight, it is the end of time. It is the end of the world. There are no more shows. There is no more music. And in a way, that finality is the artistic statement, I think.
If there's an artistic statement, it was probably just that there will be no encore.
That's a nice way of putting it.
But no, I think it was more than that for me. And I am still, even, you know, in my mid-70s, I'm still caught up in the ideas that I learned at art college. The people that taught me were the same people that taught Brian Eno. You know, we have this similar approach to music, as art, as ambience, as a, you know, a part of a social debate, all of these things. So it's more than pop music, and it's more than performing. It's an artistic act in the sense that it's an installation act. It's not appropriate to do it on TV. But David Letterman once handed me a Gibson guitar that he'd got from Gibson for nothing. And he said, will you smash it on the show? And I said, no, I don't really want to do that, David.
Yeah,
I don't want
order.
To smash it on the show. And he said, they've given it to us for nothing. And I said, no, I really don't think I should. Anyway, because it's not, you know, it's not going to be about the art. It's not going to be about the performance. It's not going to be about the closing of a show. It's not going to be about what's the significance of this instrument that somebody else, some kid would save up, you know, doing a driving job for 6 years to buy. And he said, oh, will you smash it when you learn that if you smash it, I've got somebody that's going to buy it from us for charity for $30,000.
Oh, he's good, David Letterman. Oh, he's a good one. Oh, he's the best.
So I smashed it on his show, and it was more valuable smashed than it was in one piece.
You know, one of the interesting things about listening to the demo of Pictures of Lily and hearing your thought process is that I can hear you constructing it with your friends in mind, with your players in mind. And it's interesting because it took me 2 listens of that song to realize Keith wasn't on it. Isn't that weird?
Oh, wow.
I suddenly realized on the 3rd listen, wait, there's no drums. Where's Keith? Because I put the drums in there myself.
Well, Roger always says that Keith followed everybody in the band. He made a point once when listening to some records, you know, the stems of the records, he listened to the drums and the vocals on their own. And he said to the interview, he said, listen, Keith Moon is following the vocals. He's following my vocals. And I took him to task later and I said, no, Keith was following everybody. He followed me. He followed John. The one thing that he didn't do was keep time.
But he reinvented his own. And there's been, and that's why he remains one of the single most influential, not just drummers, but musicians of all time. Because alongside John, yourself, and Roger, each of you, to me, feel like you're the leader of the band in a weird way. You're soloists. You're soloing. You're doing your own thing, and somehow it all comes together. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, it does. I think it just speaks, rather than about leadership, it speaks about being able to be in a band. You know, it's quite tough to be in a band. Anybody will tell you this. You know, there's, I've only met and become familiar with the guys from Metallica recently. They came to Hollywood Bowl to see us when we did our orchestral show. And I'd always thought of Metallica as being shredders, you know, about, you know, being, and they are shredders. They're brilliant guitar players. But what really impressed me was the fact that this contract, the better word is compact. It's a kind of where you shake hands with somebody and just say, we're going to move forward and we don't know how we're going to develop. We don't know where we're going to go, but we're going to stick together and see what happens. And they've done an incredible amount of developing different ideas. They used an orchestra before we did. They didn't have it for the whole show, but that, I think, you know, they, and it was very successful. So actually looking at a band like them, I suddenly think, wow, you know, this is the definitive bands like ZZ Top, for example. You know, in 1 year, they didn't go home for, you know, 365 days. I think their wives said, listen, it's Thanksgiving, you've got to come home. They went home and they were so screwed up with the idea of going back to their homes that they booked the families into a Holiday Inn hotel, yeah. You know, because... And, you know, people, these guys were not just fellow musicians. They were friends. They saw their upsides and their downsides. You know, Keith Moon was funny, but I also saw him in a tragic state as well, you know, and also doing terrible things. He was very kind and he did some wonderful things, but he was often really a bad guy. I think I was probably the same. We probably all were. So you see the best and the worst. That's why Roger and I are still together, despite the fact that we don't really have very much in common. You know, I'm a leftist. He's a rightist. You know, I believe in God. I don't think he does. It's a whole load of differences. You know, I'm creative. He's a singer. He doesn't write songs. I think there's a whole load of stuff that's, there's like a void between us, but when we come together, we're still honoring that contract, which we made when we were kids at school.
Wow. Straight in there. No mucking around. I love it. What's going on, Roger? How are you?
Frustrated.
Talk to me. I'm your therapist for the next hour, free of charge. Why are you frustrated?
The biggest problems we got with this thing, there's two or three problems. One is the anti-vaxxers. Very misinformed when it comes to virus. The amount of, you know, misinformation out there is unbelievable. And getting the rest of the world vaccinated. I'm astonished that the one vaccine we've got, which is the AstraZeneca, I mean, no wonder they're trying to get that off the market because they're giving it out at no profit. How dare they? How dare they do something ethical or moral?
I know.
The world out of this mess, right? How dare they? We can't have them doing that when our one costs $50 and theirs cost how much? $7? Oh, we've got to get some bad news on that a bit quick.
Spin it up. Let me ask you this, right? As someone who has been so acutely aware of the spin for so long, I feel like part of the Who's MO or ammo was to combat the spin, to recognize where all the mistruths were and to try to use music and rock and roll and subsequently all other things to push back on that. You find yourself at this point in 2021 after one of the most significant challenges in human history and the spin still spins.
You never stop it spinning. It's just getting harder to disseminate the truth. I mean, it's almost like now we should turn the whole fucking lot off. Go back to newsprint. Go back to word of mouth, and read. Start to read books again, And then we might get somewhere, because it's becoming so absurd now with AI doing all the tricks it can do, and the woke generation. It's terrifying the miserable world they're going to create for themselves. I mean, anyone who's lived a life and you see what they're doing, you just know that it's a route to nowhere, especially when you've lived through the periods of a life that we've had the privilege to. I mean, we've had the golden era. There's no doubt about that. But we came out of a war. We came out of a leveled society, completely flattened bomb sites and everything. And we built that. We've been through socialist governments. We've seen the communist system fail in the Soviet Union. I've been in those communist countries while they were communists. I've seen how wonderful, really, it was.
You said something so poignant before, having had the privilege of living through all of these things. A wonderful observation. But when you started The Who, and then several years later found yourselves making this incredible opus, right, The Who Sellout, what were the significant challenges? Because I know that you're a very globally minded person, a very intelligent person. I know you could have moved into academia if you wanted to. You obviously are very switched on. And I say that with confidence based on music and what I've read about you and what I've heard about you. So what were you observing back in 1967 that you were fighting against then? What was frustrating you then?
I don't know about frustrated. That period for me in particular, individually, emotionally, and in my private life and everything, and in the band, was a very, very difficult time for me. I'd been thrown out of the band in 1965 and brought back in. And this was my second year of probation. I wasn't quite accepted as a full band member yet. It was starting to gel again, and we were searching for a way forward, a way to be more than just a singles pop band, like an upmarket Herman's Hermits. And fortunately, we did have the intelligence, or I had the intelligence, certainly, to recognise that within the abilities of Pete Townshend, we had someone really unique in his songwriting ability. He had the ability to voice that inner voice that we all have into music in a way that it struck a chord, which in itself is timeless. That's what's so amazing when I listen back to these records, and I listen back to so much of Who stuff, and I don't particularly enjoy it because there's some painful memories in there. But I am constantly amazed that it doesn't age. I think that's to do with the fact that it's coming from a centre which is deep within us all, which is our truth. Any moment that will be part of our truth somewhere in our life, and it will resonate, and that resonance will carry it forward. It astonishes me how modern most Who music sounds today.
That was emotional for me, I'm not going to lie, because, you know, I've been interviewing people now for talking to musicians and trying to speak the artist language for 25 years. As I've continued to do this work, I've been searching for the most simple observations as to why it matters. And you summed it up so beautifully. Pete speaks truth to us all because he was unafraid to acknowledge the fractures within him and try to find ways through with his art, which is painful. Not just you're going through your own pain, that's painful process. And your band, through all the joy you gave the world, was steeped in pain. You were all in your own way fractured.
Exactly. That's where we just got lucky, our chemistry. John joined my band. He brought Pete in. Being the singer, you're always out front, so you never see the band. But what you do, more importantly than they can ever do, in a way, because they're always looking at each other. They're playing their instruments. It's a different focus. When you're the front man, everything is there to an audience. Everything they're doing behind you is channeling through you. And if you're doing the job properly, especially with things like Townshend songs, which are about that fractious inner core of us all, you've got to connect it. So the energy is focused like that. So all I ever did in the early days of putting that band together was feel. And it was the whole band was structured not on what they looked like, not on anything. It was probably the ugliest band you could ever.
What are you talking about? Ed Whistle's a supermodel. What are you talking about?
No, we weren't in those days. We were gawky, lanky. You know, God, it was a mess. But anyway, what we were putting out in energy and what the vibe was, and it was unique, and I felt that immediately. And there's just something about that we managed to just, even with all our difficulties, we knew that between us all, the sum of our parts was so much, much more.
I don't know how a band takes an Eddie Cochran song, which has been probably played at, I don't know, I'm just going to throw a number out there for the sake of conversation, 3 million parties and weddings by cover bands over the history of time, maybe more. And how you take this song is just unbelievable, the racket you make and the fact that somehow you all find a way to gel together and yet none of you seem to be playing the same thing. And it's unbelievable when you, and I'm going to give you the ultimate complimentary observation, Roger. That is a horse that cannot be rode. You cannot ride that horse. That horse is like wild. It is a stallion. Keith, John, Pete, forget it. And yet somehow you are able to get in front of it and ride it and control it.
Yeah, doing Summertime Blues is my idea. And I just kind of felt it like that. I thought, that would be a great band. That would be a great song for this band. And if it's, because Moon was always one for putting the, rather than doing the standard rock and roll beat, which is, you know, it's music, you know, it's the in-out rock and roll dance to it. Our music was fight to it, you know. It was all about putting it on the one, and that came from Keith. He just had that way. He had that way of using his drum kit to almost like the guitar, the bass, and the singer were balls of wool, and he would be the knitting needles, the drumsticks were the knitting needles, knitting it and putting it out as this energy. He had that ability to do that. And when people say he's a sloppy drummer, he's not.
What?
He just does not play standard drums. He's playing with everybody in the band at the same time. He could fire something up in the most extraordinary places. But we all had... the ability to believe and follow him, and it worked. It just worked. We're just lucky.
So, Roger, when you're on stage and that moment that you live for, that all of the disagreements and the hard work and the blood, sweat, and tears are making records, and you find yourself on stage and Keith and Pete and John are around you, and it's just like something from another planet. After being in the Who for so long, could you try to describe it? How close can you get to describing what that feeling is like for you?
In the early days, for me, it was like going to war. It was like going into battle. It really was. I for a very long time there, it was us against our audience. And we were going to drive our music through them to the back of the hall, you know. And as the halls got bigger, of course, that became more and more extravagant, and the volume went up and up and up. So that was a kind of mental attitude. It was almost like a battle. And the slightest little thing used to wind me up terrible into a lot of anger and inner anger, which again come out within the performances.
Can you give me an example of what of the kind of thing that would have set you off, Roger?
Oh, lots of things. Loads of stupid. You know, that's a time when, you know, paranoia and everything was rampant. You know, that those terrible years between the ages of 15 to 25.
You're just a misplaced human, right? You just don't know. You're like, okay, I don't fit at home anymore, and I don't know what the world wants from me, right?
That's exactly right. And you've been put on this stage in front of all these people, which, like I say, the numbers grew so rapidly. Between 1967 and 1971, we went from 1967, we were playing high school gyms. If we played to 1,000 people, that was a big crowd. Then we did Monterey, which was, I don't know how many was there, but it wasn't that big, Monterey. It's a very big festival, but it wasn't actually, I don't think there was that many people anyway, from what I can remember. And then, of course, we did Woodstock, and there was the famous half a million people. But then after that, our individual crowd, not being at a festival, went from that 1,000-2,000 people to 60, 70, 80, 100, 120,000 people within the space of sort of a year. So there you are, stuck on this stage in front of these 120,000 people, full of expectations, And it's terrifying because you don't want to let them down. So you think, well, the only way to do this is to fight it.
Well, your involvement in Woodstock always fascinated me as a child, discovering what the Woodstock concert meant to society, humanity, to the times, but also to the artists involved. There was a very clear selection of artists that seemed like a no-brainer the more you dived into it. Then there were a couple of outliers that the idea of peace and love and that kind of revolution seemed a little bit at odds with the music that was being made. Hendrix was sort of on the line. He was a little bit going to war, but he was also a little bit discovering the holistic side of life. The Who, to me, to your point, was straight up fighters. You were street fighters. What was it like when you showed up at a place like Woodstock where everyone's just looking to, you know, roll a daisy chain and hang out there and meditate through the future, and you show up and you're like, where's the fight?
You know, again, it's that thing of youth, you know, it's like what you see out there, all these protesters on the street now, you know, who are protesting for peace while they're battling everyone else that's not agreeing with them, you know. So nothing's changed. You know, nothing's changed at all. It's just, but Woodstock was a funny experience. To us, it was just another gig. It was just another show. It was nothing, you know. And they kept us waiting a long time. That was all. And it didn't mean much to us until the following year when the film came out. And the film, of course, blew us into the stratosphere.
Hyper-focusing on this album, right? The Who's Sellout, you know, the concept and how pivotal it was throughout The Who's time. What were your feelings when you started to see the idea taking shape? Were you all in? Were you like, hang on, I don't understand what this is. I have to figure this out later. You know, how invested were you in the whole concept of it?
Oh, 100%. We were always, I was always in particular 100% behind whatever people's trying to do. Didn't always understand it, but always 100% behind the concept. This was not a concept album at the time we made it. It was a lot of bits of songs that Pete had ideas, like Rael, for instance, which is it's a precursor to Tommy in a lot of ways. You can hear a lot of the bits from Amazing Journey in Rael. That was being pieced together in the studio as, you know, just scraps of paper that he had written down with this kind of synopsis of a story. And we were in the harmonies up as we went along, and it was, I can't remember where it was done, but it was a tiny, tiny little studio, not much bigger than my office here, you know. The whole idea of making it that radio show didn't happen right until the end, because all we had was a completely mishmash of a mixture of songs that didn't really make an album. It was, I always thought that it was our manager, Chris Stamp, who came up with the idea of making it like a radio show. Because it was at the time in England where they were, our music that we, the young people of that time, and indeed most of the British public, were getting most of their music from these pirate radio stations, 12 miles off the coast, beaming us all this rock music and pop music, and it was a fantastic time. But the government decided this wasn't good enough. We can't have all that freedom. And decided they were going to pull the plug and give it to the BBC, because that was a proper radio station.
All the incredible music. One of the most important things, I think, that you've dedicated your life to and really, really immersed yourself in is your work with your cancer trust and the work that you've been doing for, you know, for teenagers with cancer. And philanthropy is one of those things that people talk about. Often you get credited for the selfless expression and the selfless work, but everyone I've ever spoken to who's deeply in it actually says it's sort of the opposite. It feeds you. It actually gives you so much in a way. What has your experience been like once you started to focus on things outside of yourself and your band?
Well, I'm completely driven by this. Completely, it feels like, to me, the most important thing in my life, secondary to The Who now, because what started as just a little idea from my doctor when they started this very small charity called the Teenage Cancer Trust, I immediately got what they were trying to achieve. But as I further dug into it and met teenagers going through that system and then thought about my teenage years, which were very painful, those 13 to 25, 26, maybe even to 30, and I thought, what would those years have been like if I had been one of these teenagers with cancer, been diagnosed with cancer? So it's kind of like you put yourself in that position and you think, crikey, I, you know, I've got to do something more than is being done for this group at the moment. Because when we started this 30 years ago, virtually they were completely ignored. This age group, the adolescents and young adults, they're totally misserved by cancer research. Most of the cancer research, and I can't get numbers, it's very difficult. Quite the majority of cancer research money is charitably given. But I've got to tell you, most of that money is being spent on researching cancers in old people. Now, that doesn't make sense to me, because that just doesn't make sense. Why save the old and ignore the young? It's not right, and it needs to change, because some of the treatments that the teenagers get for cancers they are rare, I agree, and it's not easy. They are rare cancers. They're incredibly aggressive. But some of the treatments that they're on haven't changed since the 70s. Now, that's just not good enough. It's not good enough when that money is given charitably, yet all the cancer researchers are looking for that patent at the end where the drug company can make a lot of money. That's not on. And just maybe, it's been always my theory, and a lot of serious researchers agree, that they might find answers in those rare, aggressive cancers in this age group that I speak for, adolescents and young adults. They might find answers in curing them that help curing all the cancers all the way through. But they're not looking. And because they're not looking, they're never going to find them.
I'm completely immersed in what you're saying, because you are one of the few people who haven't just contributed an element or some of your time or as much as you can afford. I know, because I've spoken to artists you've called and said, I need you on this night. And you are unafraid to make that call because of the passion, because of what you're trying to, just not just about the night or about getting someone to play a show. It's all just a step in the direction you're talking about. Like, I just got to just keep chipping away.
Everyone in the music business, they owe their career to this age group. We wouldn't have a music business. We would have half the bloody things on YouTube if we didn't have this age group. If you've got to be there for them. And this, if the governments won't change it, and the system and the big pharma and all that other stuff won't change it, let's change it ourselves. We can do it. We built our industry. Look, it's a multi-billion pound industry, for goodness sake. We can do this. We've just got the public to understand what we're trying to do.
It speaks to the core of what motivates The Who all the way through, which is this youthful rebellion, this idea that you might discount us and think that we're stupid and unable to manage our emotions, but we just channel them in a different way, right? That's ultimately really is at the core of The Who's entire philosophy, right? Is the fight for truth within the youth.
That's right.
We're talking to Roger Daltrey. It's a beautiful moment today for me to be able to really come face-to-face. Well, I wish it was, but as close to face-to-face in a pandemic as I can with a real hero, someone whose music has raised me like millions of others, you know, and given me a voice when I haven't had it. The Who Sellout, this super deluxe edition, about as super as it gets, over 100 outtakes and things like that. Did you sort of... I know Pete's obsessed about this because I spoke to him. He's like, oh, I listen to it all and I dissect and da-da-da. And it just sounds like it's entirely his bag. Were you right there beside him going through it all, or were you like, just, you know, send me the ones you like?
I have to say that these new editions, it's really good for the fans, but I've got no interest in them whatsoever, to be honest with you. To me, when I record a song and I do the song and put it down, that's like a painting. It's finished. Huh. I walk away from it. And these things, it's like, I sometimes feel a bit like a used car salesman. These things come out. But there again, it is important. They are important. I'm not unappreciative of what Pete does and the amount of work he puts into them. They are important. It's just that my particular bit in the group, that was done 50 years ago, and I like to leave it there.
Pete mentioned that he spoke very fondly of his relationship with you, whilst also highlighting that you're fundamentally very different human beings. How important have some of those really sort of, not divisive, but fundamental differences been to the longevity of the band? And how, you know, how different would it have been if you'd both had seen eye to eye on religion, on politics, on creative decisions, all these things?
I think on religion, we're pretty eye to eye. I mean, he's very spiritual. I'm very spiritual. I'm I'm an atheist, but he's not. Politics, I don't think he quite understands my politics. I'm not left, I'm not right. I'm trying to find a way in the middle because all I see is the rest of it being divisive. And I work in the game, going back to the Teenage Cancer Trust, working in an area that is not music. I see the way political people use, for instance, our health service, for instance. They use it as a political football. A health service should never be that. It should be there for us all equally, you know. But we're in a ridiculous situation where we've got all these people making promises they're never going to keep.
A friend of mine said to me the other day, who's a musician, he said, if you're picking a side, you missed the point. And I was like, I had to really think about that for a second. And what he was saying was, I don't know if you can trust any of them.
The trouble is with human beings, there are those that will take, and there are those that will keep give. But there has to be a balance.
When the wheels start turning again and there's no more looking back and no more retrospective time to focus on putting things out and da 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 da, what is your hope for you and Pete? Like, what's the first thing you want to get back up and running again with The Who? What do you want to do?
I want to get back on stage doing the show that we were right in the middle of a tour that got cancelled. To honour our commitment to our fans, we had a charity show booked in Cincinnati that we were doing for Finneytown High School to provide scholarships into the future, way after our death. So their commitments that we will do, even if it's in 2 years' time and I'm 80 years old, I'll hobble on that stage somehow, and we will honour that, and we will raise that. That will be a sellout crowd. It might be The Who's last. When we get our word to do something, we end up doing it, but I just want to go on as long as we can doing music of the quality we make and doing it justice. I mean, The Who have never, ever cheated. I mean, I don't know whether you saw our last tour with an orchestra. It is phenomenal. And it's not the usual rock band and an orchestra where the strings and all the orchestra could be done on a keyboard. This is serious. This is like, whoa. It's because The Who is as ballsy and as loud as ever, and the orchestra sits in between this, just makes it, it takes your face off. It is huge. And I was so proud of that show, and Pete and I were enjoying it so much. Because in our heads, when you're singing, you know, I always try and sing the songs as though I'm singing them for the first time. And then when you hear an orchestra kick in with all the harmonics that a real live orchestra brings, with the arrangements we've got, it just takes your spirit to a whole new level. It's just wonderful. Do that. I want to do that. I'd like to, let's see if we couldn't write an album together. I'd love to have a go at that. Just get in a studio, and even if it's a blues album, you know, lockdown blues, I don't know.
I've enjoyed our conversation so much. You know, I knew I would. I respect your approach to your art. I have huge amounts of respect for what you do for society and the way that you move. And I really admire your honesty, man. You're a no bullshit human. Thank you, brother.
All right. Be lucky, bro.
Back-to-back conversations, but in separate locations, which is kind of how it is, I guess. Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend from The Who. The album, The Who Sellout, Super Deluxe Edition. You know, if you're a Who fan, then, you know, you're happy as a pig in mud, man. Unbelievable. Another conversation coming next week. Add a rating or a comment and follow this series right here. And we'll keep you updated with all the good conversations that we have. Appreciate it.